this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Welcome. I'm Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues, bringing you information from respected sources about health matters that may be helpful for you or those you care about in consultation with your health care provider. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from a number of sources that I'll name as we go along. This first article comes to us from the Harvard Health Letter, and it's about a blood test that checks for dozens of different cancers. Multi-cancer early detection tests hold the promise of better outcomes, but it's important to understand their current limitations. Catching cancer early, long before any symptoms appear, increases the odds of successful treatment. It's why doctors recommend cancer screening tests that detect colon, breast, cervical, or lung cancer. In recent years, another option has emerged: blood tests that screen for many types of cancer. Known as multi-cancer early detection, or MCED tests, they offer the potential to detect up to 50 types of cancer from a single blood draw. But before you take one, make sure you understand exactly what these blood tests can and can't detect. Over the past 20 years, we've seen a revolution in new cancer therapies. Now we're at the start of another revolution focused on early cancer detection, says Dr. Elizabeth O'Donnell, director of the Multi-Cancer Early Detection Clinic at Harvard-affiliated Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. As she points out, 70% of cancer deaths stem from cancers for which there is no screening test. MCED tests now have the potential to find many more cancers earlier, including less common but more lethal types, like ovarian and pancreatic cancer, she adds. MCED tests, also known as liquid biopsy tests, measure substances circulating in the blood. These include cells or genetic material shed by tumors, or proteins or other biological markers that suggest cancer may be lurking somewhere in the body. But just as a suspicious spot on a mammogram doesn't always indicate cancer, an abnormal result from an MCED test only indicates the possibility of cancer, not a definitive diagnosis. While some tests suggest the likely organ site of the cancer, others do not. Additional testing, which usually involves scans and biopsies, is needed to confirm a cancer diagnosis. Many MCED tests are under development. While none are yet approved by the FDA, several are commercially available, including the Galleri test and the CancerGuard tests. Insurance plans do not typically cover the costs of these tests, which run about $700 to $950. In theory, these tests could make cancer screening more broadly accessible, since a blood test is easier, less invasive, and less time-consuming than screening tests such as colonoscopies and mammograms. Cancer is classified based on the extent of the disease, from stage 0, meaning abnormal cells are present, to stage 4, in which the cancer has spread to distant sites of the body. Finding cancer at an early stage can increase the likelihood of successful treatment, says Dr. O'Donnell. In general, cancer progression is lower and survival is much higher when people are treated at an early stage, she says. In addition, the MCED test results may reveal genetic information that enables a physician to choose a more targeted and potentially more effective treatment. Currently available therapies, especially new immune-based cancer treatments, can extend lives, but they're very expensive and require a lot of resources to create, says Dr. O'Donnell. My hope is that we'll get to a point where we can cure people before these therapies are even needed and keep people out of cancer treatment centers, she says. So what are the possible downsides? MCED tests are not perfect. Sometimes the results suggest a person has cancer when they actually do not, known as a false positive. Other times, The results indicate a person does not have a cancer when they actually do, a false negative. Overall, these tests can correctly detect cancer more than half the time, although this varies by cancer type and stage. The most recent results from the first commercially available test, Galeri, were presented at the European Society for Medical Oncology in October 2025. For every 10 people who have a positive test, 6 will actually have cancer. Let me say that again. For every 10 people who have a positive test, 6 will actually have cancer. All positive results require further testing, which takes time, adds cost, and may involve health risks from the diagnostic procedures themselves, not to mention the added stress and anxiety. False negative results are rare, but they could delay treatment if a person later ignores real symptoms due to a false sense of security. Oncologists have described MCED tests as potentially transformative, but note that no studies have assessed the benefit of MCEDs for finding cancer or for improving either the quality or length of a person's life. Such studies take decades to complete because they're based on survival, and that's not yet available for MCED testing, says Dr. O'Donnell. Who should get the test? Right now, we don't have evidence to say who should or shouldn't get an MCED test, says Dr. O'Donnell. But people with a strong family history of cancer could be candidates. For them, screening may feel empowering and might even cause less anxiety than doing nothing, she says. MCED testing, which requires a prescription, represents a new paradigm for cancer screening because people can not only request the test from their own doctor, but they can also request a test online. Only about 1 to 2% will get a test, will get a result suggesting they have cancer. But we need to be very careful to ensure these people have the right follow-up testing, says Dr. O'Donnell. She suggests seeking out a cancer trial at a major cancer center, which may provide the test for no charge and provide appropriate follow-up. Continuing from the Harvard Health Letter, this article is an essential way to combat loneliness. To fight this problem that threatens health and longevity, strengthen relationships you already have. Research shows that about 1/3 of all Americans report feeling lonely. This loneliness epidemic in the United States is taking a toll on people's physical and mental health. Mental health problems linked to loneliness include higher rates of anxiety, depression, suicide, anger, and violence. Loneliness also affects physical health, contributing to an increased risk of heart disease, stroke, high blood pressure, infection, diabetes, dementia, and even early death. One effective way to cope with loneliness is to strengthen your existing relationships and reconnect with friends and family who may have drifted apart. Loneliness is a feeling that you are not connected to other people or that you don't belong. Lonely people feel as if they don't have anyone they can confide in or do things with. It's possible to be surrounded by people and still feel lonely. There are many factors that can contribute to feeling lonely. Friends or family members may no longer live nearby. Participation in volunteer or religious groups is declining. Online shopping makes it easy to rarely leave the house, reducing opportunities to meet new people or run into friends and acquaintances. Social media sometimes causes people to compare their lives with others and may create feelings of coming up short or missing out. For some people, having a chronic illness, losing a spouse, having a low income, or recently moving to a new home or job can contribute to loneliness. And of course, the COVID-19 pandemic was a major factor in fueling the loneliness epidemic. You might think the best way to deal with loneliness is to make new friends, and that can certainly be helpful. But be sure also to consider the relationships you already have. You have a head start when you can draw on shared memories and experiences. It's not so simple, however. Relationships take effort. If they aren't nurtured, they can wither and fade. A strong first step toward conquering loneliness is to think about what you can do to improve existing relationships in your life. One way to build deeper connections with family and friends is by demonstrating that you care about them. To do that, you might consider scheduling times to get together regularly, sharing how much they mean to you, and don't assume they already know, listening as much as you speak, minimizing distractions, such as frequently checking your smartphone or glancing at TV programs when you're together, asking questions about their lives and activities. Another way to cope with loneliness is to reach out to a friend or family member with whom you've lost contact. If you don't have their phone number, you might ask a mutual acquaintance or family member, or you might find them through an online search. You might also be able to find the person by simply searching for his or her name on social media, such as Facebook. The person you're looking for will likely be happy to reconnect with you. Recalling good times and fond memories can give both of you a lift. Physical distance doesn't have to be a barrier. If you live a few hours apart, consider meeting at a location in the middle once a month or every few months. For example, you might try out different lunch spots each time you see each other, or visit an attraction that interests you both, such as a museum, a historical site, a botanical garden, a zoo, or an art gallery. Or you might schedule an activity, such as going on day trips to new towns together, perhaps even signing up for a tour, or hiking together in a park you can both visit. If you are unable to meet in a person, communicate in other ways, and if needed, schedule time to connect. Here are some ideas. Plan a regular weekly or monthly time when you can connect on the phone or with a video call. Send cards or letters to each other each month. Send a good morning text each day or a good night text each evening. Create a cooking club where you and a friend prepare the same meal and share tips and recipes. Read the same book or watch the same movie and then discuss it over the phone. It takes time to nurture relationships, but it can be one of the easiest and most rewarding ways to combat loneliness. More than just making you feel better, it might also help protect your health. You know, I would love to hear from you. I bet some of you have other ideas for how to nurture and grow the relationships you already have. So if you have those, please send them to me. Send them to ncreadingservice.org and address them to Deborah Love, and I'll get them and be happy to read them on air. Thank you. Okay, this next article is continuing with Harvard Health, and it's entitled, Are Lunges Safe as We Get Older? Lunges are an excellent exercise for maintaining vital leg strength. If you don't feel as strong as you once did, it's not surprising. Everyone loses muscle mass with age. Muscle weakness in the legs can make it difficult to get up from a chair, walk, or climb stairs, and it increases the risk of falling. But muscle weakness is not inevitable. You can build leg strength and stability with a targeted exercise routine. One recommended exercise is the lunge. A lot of my patients roll their eyes when I show them the lunge, says Christina Ruggieri, a physical therapist at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehabilitation. But this is an excellent exercise, especially for older adults. A lunge is a lower body exercise that resembles a modified single-leg squat. For the basic forward lunge exercise, start with your legs together. Step forward so you are in a split stance with one foot in front and the other behind. Bend your knees to lower your body and return to a standing position. Your back knee is going to essentially kiss the floor, says Ruggieri. Other variations include the reverse lunge, walking lunge, and side lunge. The muscles work during lunges are the quadriceps, which is the front of the thigh, the hamstrings, which is the back of the thigh, and the gluteals, which are the buttocks. Lunges also engage the hips, core, and back muscles. Lunges are great for older adults because they help improve strength, flexibility, coordination, and balance. You need these to do the lunge, and you also need them for basic daily activities, like walking, negotiating stairs, or even getting up from the floor, says Ruggieri. If you're sitting on the floor playing with your grandchildren, or you happen to fall and have trouble getting up, the way to push yourself back up is to work through the lunge position. So, what do you need to do the lunge? Lunges are generally safe for everyone, including older adults, but there are exceptions. To prevent injury, you must have the leg strength to do them correctly, says Ruggieri. You shouldn't strain when doing a lunge. Straining can lead to muscle or tendon injuries that can take weeks to heal. People with significant knee, hip, or back problems should check with their doctor, a physical therapist, or personal trainer before starting an exercise program that includes lunges. If you don't have sufficient leg strength, don't avoid the lunge. Instead, work to build up the strength to do it. Start light, go slow, and progress when you feel strong enough. If someone attempts to do a lunge and they are struggling, I suggest starting with simple modification, says Ruggieri. For example, instead of lowering your back knee all the way toward the floor, go only halfway down or even less. Gradually increase the depth of the lunges. If you have balance issues, brace yourself next to a wall and lower yourself down part way. You can also hold on to a railing or a cane for balance. If your right foot is forward, hold the support with your left hand for stability. Or another thing you can do is place your front foot on a low step or box to reduce the range of motion. Once you've mastered the modified version, continue progressing until you can perform a full forward lunge. Ruggieri suggests starting with 2 sets of 10 lunges, going a quarter of the way down for several weeks. Once you feel strong enough, do 1 set going halfway and 1 set going a quarter of the way. Keep increasing every few weeks. Do these and other strength training exercises 3 times a week with at least 1 day in between. If you're having difficulty with the forward lunge, try a reverse lunge by starting with your legs together and stepping backward into the lunge position. This can be easier on the knees. Another way to make lunges easier is to perform them in a pool. When you're exercising in water, the buoyancy of the water supports your body weight. You can practice lunges and other exercises with less stress on your joints. It takes about 9 weeks of consistent training to build strength. Everyone progresses at a different rate. Feel how your body is reacting to the exercise, says Ruggieri. If you feel you're not there yet, stay at the same level until you're able to progress. Once you've mastered the forward lunge, you can advance to other variations. For side lunges, step out to the side and bend your knee. This builds groin and hip strength. This is more advanced because we don't walk sideways, says Ruggieri. For a walking lunge, move forward with each lunge, alternating the legs. This requires greater balance and coordination. Once you can do lunges easily, you can increase the difficulty by adding weights. Start by holding 5 pounds or less and gradually increase the weight. If you don't yet have the strength to do a lunge, you can start with the modifications described above or try a basic squat or sit to stand. For a sit to stand, stand in front of a chair. Lower your body as if you were going to sit down, but instead just tap the seat with your buttocks and stand up again. If this is too difficult, place a pillow on the chair. Do 2 sets of 10, tapping the pillow. Continue working until you can remove the pillow. Sit to stands are excellent for maintaining strength for functional activities, such as getting out of bed, off a toilet, and out of a car, says Ruggieri. So I'm going to editorialize a little bit here. This is Deb talking. When I first started doing lunges with my trainer 12 years ago, I hated them. And now I absolutely love them. It, as the article says, it took several weeks before I could feel up to doing them without being in discomfort. But it has really been worth it in terms of my mobility and balance. So I think this is a really important article. So it's March. The weather is finally starting to warm up. And spring can't be far off, right? Lately, the birds have been going full throttle, at least outside my house. This next article is from NYU Langone Health News Hub, and it might prompt you to listen to those bird calls in a slightly different way. It's entitled, Understanding Parakeet Songs Could Help Decode Speech Disorders. Humans are by nature a highly social species. Many of us can spend hours chatting and storytelling with friends, family, and colleagues. But an estimated 15% of people in the United States have a communication disorder, including ones that disrupt how they share or receive information, preventing them from either planning what they're going to say or getting the words out. A new study may help decode the complex process that causes speech to break down among those who have autism, have suffered a stroke or a traumatic brain injury, or have another speech-impairing condition. For the first time, NYU Langone Health has recorded the brain activity of another highly social species, the small, long-tailed Australian parrots known as budgerigars, commonly called parakeets in the United States, as they communicated with each other. Our researchers found that the budgerigar brain has clusters of neurons that light up when they make specific notes, like the patterns that drive human speech. The study, published in the journal Nature, reveals the presence of a human-like brain map that allows parrots to readily produce a wide range of sounds by using a kind of vocal keyboard. Senior author Michael A. Long, Ph.D., the Thomas and Susan Murphy Professor of Neuroscience and Physiology, and a professor in the Department of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery, compares the discovery to figuring out the piano keys that correspond to each component of their song. We finally found a species other than humans that has this map, providing an important parallel to human speech, says Dr. Long. Understanding the rules and steps governing parrot vocalizations, he adds, could lead to new insights into the brain processes that underlie normal and disordered language use in humans. One bird that has long been studied in animal communication, a songbird called the zebra finch, imitates the short courtship song of an older tutor by practicing it hundreds of thousands of times to make a perfect copy. Another animal, the Costa Rican singing mouse, sings an elaborate song to mark and defend its territory. Dr. Long has studied both species, which share complementary vocal strategies with humans, even though they can produce only a limited sound repertoire. The budgerigar, by contrast, is a masterful mimic that can learn and repeat hundreds of human words, an enthusiastic storyteller that can engage in elaborate dialogues with other budgerigars. To better understand its exceptional ability to learn and produce new sounds, Dr. Long and postdoctoral researcher Zetian Yang, Ph.D., tracked the bird activity of the brain activity of the birds as they communicated with each other. When one of the parrots sang specific notes akin to human vowels or consonants, the researchers saw corresponding nerve cells light up in the anterior archopallium, a key part of the avian forebrain. We can look at the activity of just five of the neurons and know what the bird is singing about without listening to the song, says Dr. Long. To encourage the budgerigar banter, researchers created a cocktail party-like arena in the shape of a figure eight. At one end, they placed a single parakeet behind a clear window so they could simultaneously record both its sing-song messages and brain activity. At the other, they grouped another four parrots together, allowing them to spend hours chit-chatting with each other and the distant bird through the window. When we looked at the parrot's pattern of brain activity, we asked the question, does it resemble what we've seen in the songbird or what has been observed in the human brain, Dr. Long says. The answer, resoundingly, is it's more like a human. Once the researchers learn more about the mechanics of budgerigar songs, they hope to be able to translate what the birds are telling each other. In the meantime, the Long Lab plans further explorations that could inform our understanding of the brain processes that go awry in communication disorders. What we want to find out now is, how does a bird recall something from its environment and make those sounds in order to interact with another bird, explains Dr. Long. This study opens enormous possibilities for understanding how this amazing creature does this and gaining insight into how humans do it, how these processes break down, and how to fix them once it happens. Who knew what we could learn from the birds? We have time for just one quickie. This is a question to the Ask the Doctor feature in the Harvard Health Letter. The question, is there really such a thing as an empty calorie? What does it mean? The answer, calories are units representing the ability of food to be converted by the body into energy. All food contains calories, and we need a certain amount of calories each day. But some foods provide not only calories, but also other ingredients that are critically important, such as vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, and others. When a food provides primarily calories and little else of value to our health, we say that food has empty calories. Examples include beverages like sugary soda and foods like buttery pastries. They provide little health value. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Deborah Love, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. I'd love to hear from you. Are there topics you'd like to hear more about? That number again is 919-832-5138. As always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.